He's our chair for the Social Cultural Anthropology Program, which is the sponsor for this evening's lecture. So,
wow, this is an impressive turnout. Thank you so much for coming. This is our first event as the new chapter in the history of anthropology, social and cultural anthropology department here at CIS, and this is the first of many events of this kind. So I'm sure I'm going to be seeing many of you again here. It is a great privilege to introduce David Graeber and to welcome David Graeber, who is in many ways an inspiration, personal. David is a friend. David is also a mentor. David is a person whom Maurice Bloch recently, famously, called the greatest anthropological theorist of his generation from anywhere in the world. And this is a high praise that is well deserved. I met David actually now many years ago when he was writing a book called Fragments of Anarchist Anthropology. He already, which he wrote for his mentor and supervisor, Marshall Salins of University of Chicago, he already published a book called Anthropological Towards Anthropological Theory of Value, which was hailed as one of the greatest and most interesting interventions in anthropological theory. After that, he published his book, his dissertation, really, with the title Lost People, Magic and Slavery in Madagascar, another book that won high acclaim. Then came what might be termed AK Trilogy, three books for AK Press here in Oakland. One of them is Direct Action and Ethnography, an exquisite book. The other one is collection of essays, which is called Possibilities. And finally, a book that he edited, which is called Constituent Imagination. And I think these books you can find outside, I hope, and I think that they are for sale. After that, David published a book that brought him here, and that's the book Major Historical Monograph on Debt, First 5,000 Years. In many ways, David was already well-known, but if he was well-known before, now he's truly famous. And we are very, very happy to welcome him here. But David is not only an academic. David is also an activist. And some of you maybe remember David Dellinger. He wrote a book, From Yale to Jail. That was his autobiography. Something similar happened to David. He was unceremoniously, what is the word that they use now, denied tenure at Yale. Oh, well. Which was so outrageous that even Charlie Rose had to invite him on his show. Right? However, David landed at Goldsmiths, one of the best universities in the United Kingdom, and one of the things about David's activism that always fascinated me was the way that he combined it with scholarship. So when I took towards an anthropological theory of value, there was a note of acknowledgments. And acknowledgments were after family, after friends, to all of those people with whom I enjoyed breaking or tearing down walls in Quebec City. It was an acknowledgement to one of the foremost books in modern anthropological theory. David was also one of the best interviews that I heard David give was when he was handcuffed in D.C. by the D.C. police. He gave an excellent interview. I always wondered, how were you able to focus? And finally, many of you know David from his Occupy stage of his career, let's put it like this, as an activist. When I say Occupy, I mean that David was one of the people, one of the, if I'm not mistaken, three people, or maybe a little bit more, who facilitated the first General Assembly at Zuccotti Park. He also coined the now famous slogan 99%. And he also provided some of the very valuable, and I think actually tremendously important, intellectual frameworks for understanding the movement. Right now he's working on a book for Random House on the history of Occupy movement, and I'm very much looking forward to reading that book. In any case, this is our first lecture, Department of Anthropology at Social and Cultural Anthropology here at CIS is delighted to welcome Professor Dr. Graeber.
So thanks so much. I wanted to talk a little bit about how I came to write this book. It's really the last of a series. Most of the books are ones that Andre mentioned, a series of works where I've been trying to grapple with the problem of what is the role of an intellectual in social movements once you sort of jettison the traditional sort of vanguardist model? I mean, we used to know what our role was. We are to go out there and get the correct analysis of the world situation so as to bring other people up to the right level of consciousness and all that kind of thing. Most of us have realized that that's wrong. But what then do we do? And I've been casting around of it really ever since I became fully politicized at the relatively late age of 39. I had always considered myself political in the abstract. Actually, I read somewhere recently that I've been an anarchist since I was 16 years old. I think that might be true. I was an anarchist in the sense of I was in a situation where it's almost inevitable that one is an anarchist. My father actually had been in the international brigades. He fought in Spain. He was in the ambulance corps, and he was posted in Barcelona. That's where the ambulance corps was based. And at that time, Barcelona was being run on anarchist principles. And actually, he always considered this one of the great historical experiments of all time. What they basically did in the revolution of Barcelona, they had one basic policy, this: get rid of all white-collar workers. Fired them all. And what they discovered was, white-collar workers don't actually do anything. I mean, you eliminate them, and everything pretty much continues more or less as it had before. Basically all those guys do is they sort of sit around thinking of ways to make you feel bad about yourself. Anyway, this is how he described it. Even though the internationals had been propagandized against the anarchists, and he never actually called himself an anarchist, he was sympathetic with the anarchist position and always felt that it was a legitimate political philosophy, and it does work. And if you actually think that, it's rather hard not to be an anarchist because, the way I always put it is, most people don't think anarchism is a bad idea. They think it's insane. sure, yeah, get rid of the cops, get rid of the prisons, everybody will be nice to each other, right. If you've actually seen it work in practice, then, you don't think of it as insane. There's almost no reason not to embrace it. So, in theory, I was an anarchist. I didn't do much about it. I tried to get involved every now and then in the 80s, and I was kind of put off by what I saw. I became an anthropologist, and by sheer coincidence, at least I think it was coincidence, I ended up doing my field work in rural Madagascar in a place where, in fact, the state had ceased to exist. Oh, thank you. Water. Which is actually very interesting as well, because another one of the arguments always used against anarchism is a sort of commonsensical notion that everybody has that, if there were no police, people would just start killing each other. The interesting thing is that this statement can be empirically tested. There are plenty of places in the world where it has, in fact, happened that the police disappeared. And, they don't. They don't actually start killing each other. It doesn't happen. In fact, in Madagascar, not only did they not start killing each other, but they all sort of collaborated together to make sure that nobody figured out that the police had gone away. So it actually took me about 6 months to figure out that I was living in a place that had essentially liberated itself from the state, because they'd done it so subtly you couldn't notice. And they were like, what, government? Yeah, there's an office right there, what are you talking about? And there were guys in the office typing things. Later I realized that, not only were they not being paid, they actually had to buy their own paper to type this stuff on, because nothing was being requisitioned. But, there's a sort of traditional mode, you might say, of peasant resistance in a place like Madagascar. These guys are masters of layer on layer of passive resistance. But sort of number one principle is, if somebody shows up and tells you things you don't want to do, be very nice to them. Give them coffee, agree with anything they say, ask intelligent questions, and then when they go away, pretend the whole thing never happened. It's like, what guy? No, nobody came by. So there's sort of layer on layer of that. It was very difficult to do this sort of thing under the French colonial regime, but suddenly, since IMF austerity measures were causing the government to cut back anyway, they sort of maneuvered the government into a position where they made it very, very easy for them to sort of play along. They made it clear anybody who is in a position of authority, we will give you incredible honor and respect as long as you don't try to exercise your authority. And, you know, if you do, we'll make your life a living hell. So it was working. But part of the game was that we were supposed to pretend the government was still there. And the only way I actually figured out what was really going on was there's this guy who was named Henri. He was like the town bully. He was this big guy, and he was either insane or pretended to be insane. Opinions were mixed as to which. And you know, he was really horrible. He was like really violent. He would beat people up. He would try to rape people. He would just take whatever he wanted from stores. And people decided after a few years they had to do something about this guy. It seems that in Madagascar, there is a principle that if you want to lynch someone, you have to get their parents' permission first. I mean, think about it, it's quite ingenious, right? And because, you know, you'll be pretty sure it's not going to happen unless there's a really good reason. And basically, you know, it gives your dad or your mom an excuse to say, look, kid, you really better clean up your act. So they tried this a few times, and the father gave up and said, okay, do what you have to do. It was sort of like Frankenstein. They came at him with agricultural implements. And he was wounded. He ran into the local Catholic church and asked for sanctuary. Priests smuggled him out to an insane asylum in another town where he was actually kicked out a few days later for beating up the other patients, but he never came back. So, you know, it worked. When I was told this story, I suddenly realized, wait a minute. There's a police station in town, you know. Why didn't the police do something about this guy? And they were all like, well, have you seen Henri? I mean, he's enormous. yeah, but, you know, the police have guns. And it's like, yeah, I didn't want to shoot him. I mean, so it just seemed like that wasn't really their business, you know, to worry about people like that. Police keep the roads open. You know, so the police would go up and down the highway, and they'd keep the highway clear, and they wouldn't go off the highway. It was a paved roads. Was basically the highway. If somebody was murdered in the full sight of other people who then went to the police to complain, then, you know, maybe the police would go off the paved road and into the countryside. But other than that, they just really didn't want to be bothered. So no one was paying taxes. Police wouldn't come. You know, it was an anarchy, but nobody wanted you to know. So I thought this is fascinating. I went back to University of Chicago. I finished my dissertation. Ended up getting a job at Yale. One day I was teaching a course, I finished my lecture and walked out. There was a newspaper box, and I looked at the newspaper box, and it said, martial law declared in Seattle. And, you know, like most of America, I sort of said, what? So I checked into it and discovered that over the years, when I wasn't paying attention, the social movement that I'd always kind of wished would exist had actually come into existence. So, you know, I quickly said, okay, where do I sign up? Showed up. And I quickly learned two things that kind of threw me for an intellectual loop in a way that I've been kind of come to terms with ever since. And one of them was, you know, the big thing was consensus process, which I'd never heard of before until I joined this group. And it was like, it was amazing, you know, this whole new method of doing direct democracy. And I quickly realized that, I mean, that's how people had been doing decisions in Madagascar for 1,000 years. I'd been watching people do consensus process over and over and over again. The reason I hadn't fully realized, I mean, I kind of knew in the abstract that's what people did. But the reason I hadn't really understood what I'd been seeing is that people in Madagascar are really good at it. You know, this is the way all people make decisions at all things all the time, so they don't really have to spell it all out. You know, we were terrible. We just had no idea. Because, you know, the average American, I mean, we think of ourselves as living in a democratic society. That's like what makes us great and gives us the right to beat up everybody else in the world, right? But how many of us have actually taken part in making a democratic decision together? You know, normally, you know, maybe if we're ordering a pizza or something like that. So we had to figure it all out and spell it all out. And thus, I suddenly had the language, and I was looking back and saying, oh, yeah, that was a block that guy was doing. I see. Actually, they go beyond our version of blocks. In Madagascar, they have what I would call the existential block. You know, if you just don't feel right, you say, wait, I don't agree. I'd always be like, what the hell is going on? Nobody asked him to agree to anything. It would be like this way of saying, I just block everything. Something is terribly wrong. Let's figure out what it is. deeply ingrained culture of consensus. Anyway, so that was one. That was easier to handle than the other one, which is a lot of, you know, something like the Direct Action Network, which is the group I was involved with. I would say that we thought of what we were doing as the diametrical opposite, the group we kind of defined ourselves against. Imagine the sort of like classic sectarian Trotskyist or Maoist sort of little political party. Those guys are always trying to sell you the newspaper during the demonstration. You know, and they're always like 12 people, but they're a political party which dreams of seizing state power. And they always have their one intellectual leader who has the correct analysis of everything. And if you don't agree with them, you can get kicked out. So you start by having the, you know, the brilliant mind with the correct analysis, and you don't really worry about process at all. So we are trying to be as far from that as possible. It's like based on heterogeneity, we all have our own incommensurable perspectives. That's a strength, not a weakness. It involved a whole different way of talking and arguing and reaching decisions. But the thing that disturbed me was the realization that the way that sectarians argued was really very similar to the way that I had been taught to argue as a graduate student at University of Chicago. In fact, I even found myself making up this sort of little how-to list, you know, how to make a sectarian argument. If I remember correctly, there were three main principles. Number one was if you are listening to another person saying something who isn't coming from your position, and there's two different ways of interpreting what they're saying, one of which gives them some credit for common sense, don't choose that one. always assume they're as stupid as possible, or their argument is. Number two is, you know those guys who, like, they kind of go off with, they go wander around with, like, a list of 27 different ways to be wrong. And they just listen to you long enough to figure out which one to plug you into. It's like, oh, I got it. You're a cooperativist. You think. And then they start lecturing you about what you think, right? Okay, so that's number two. And number three is, you know, take any sort of, like, theoretical, subtle theoretical difference and turn it into a vast moral flaw. Okay, so those are the three, you know, and I realize this is what I was taught to do. And I began thinking, well, what would a mode of intellectual practice be like that didn't do that? That was more similar to the spirit of what people were doing in Madagascar, that we were trying to figure out how to do here. And I've been, what is the role of the intellectual if you're not going to be the leader of your little grouplet and, with the correct analysis? And I've been thinking about that and thinking about it. And in a way, every book I've written since has been an attempt to address this problem in one way or another. I wrote a little book called Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology, where I sort of set it out. I wrote an ethnography. The Direct Action book is really based on the idea that an ethnography of direct action actually could further the aim that we were involved of spreading the idea of direct action and direct democracy. So an ethnography I thought would be useful. I tossed it around in different ways. And this book on debt really came out of the same thing. I mean, it's a 5,000-year history, but it's inspired originally by an intellectual problem, and not just an intellectual problem, I think a moral problem, that activists run into all the time. I start the book of a conversation. I'm in Westminster Abbey for reasons I prefer not to go into. I was at a garden party in Westminster Abbey, and the priest was introducing me to all his friends who were the people who were there. He's a very nice man. His name was Father Graham. He's like descended great-great-great-grandson for one of the conquerors of India. There were like pith helmets in his room. And he was a nice guy. And he was but he had this really annoying habit of introducing me to people of, you know, hello, I'd like you to meet David Graeber. He's an anarchist. kind of limited possibilities for future conversation. So finally Father Graham introduced me to this guy, a woman. I can't remember her name. But this young woman, she was a lawyer. I said, oh, this person you're going to really like, you're going to have a lot in common. She's an activist like you are. She's involved in all this sort of legal community support things. And so, you know, she told me about what she does, and I started telling her about what I did, and I was involved in the global justice movement, started talking about structural adjustment policies and the IMF and all the terrible things that they had done and how we'd mobilized against them. I even told a story about Madagascar. I mean, one of the curious things about structural adjustment policies in Madagascar, these are the, you know, when a IMF sort of comes into a country which is in danger of defaulting on their debts and renegotiates things and sort of impose all of these terms. That's how they basically rewrote the economies of most of the countries in the world and forced them to do things that no elected government would ever be able to do. In Madagascar, it was sort of double-edged because, in a way, the disappearance of the police in a lot of rural areas were directly related to this. They couldn't afford to pay all the civil servants, and they thought, hell, we're not getting any money out of the countryside anyway. We'll just pull out the cops. So, and that was a positive effect. There were also some pretty negative effects. For example, where I was, there had been a malaria eradication program in the 30s where they'd wiped out mosquitoes. Everybody lost their immunity. They'd lost their immunity to malaria. Since, of course, you know, Citibank can't be asked to take a haircut on their loans, no matter how tiny. Madagascar was forced to, you know, cut the maintenance program. Of course, malaria returns. 10,000 people died in the year that there was an epidemic where 10,000 people died in the year before I arrived, but half of whom were children. And I was telling her about this, right? And she was like, "Yes, but what did you want to, you know, intend to do about it?" And I said, "Well, you know, debt cancellation." And she kind of gave me this look, like, "Yeah, but they'd borrowed the money. I mean, you know, surely people have to pay their debts, right?" And, you know, it's kind of one of those, one of these conversations. I thought this was, like, on my side. All right. And, you know, you go through the 12 different responses. Which do you do first? And when I talk to activists, you know, we've all had this conversation, right? You know, they didn't really borrow the money and talk about, you know, what happened. You talk about the fact they actually have paid the money several times over, but, you know, through the miracle of compound interest, they'll continue paying it forever. Do you talk about the – I actually tried the economics approach. You know, actually, according to economic theory, profit is your reward for risk. So if you're not taking a risk when you're making a loan, you know, there's no point. I mean, in fact, that's what guides you to profitable investments, right? Because, you know, if you could collect on any loan, you know, I walked into the bank and I said, "I just got a hot tip on the horses. Can I have $10 million? You know, and they knew that, like, if I didn't pay, they could take my organs or sell my family into slavery or something. You know, they'd say, sure. You know, so the only reason that money actually, the financial system works the way it does is the possibility of default. So I mentioned all these things. But afterwards, I was thinking about it, and I thought that sort of moral certainty just haunted me. This is a nice person. You know, she was involved in all sorts of do-gooder sort of activities. And, you know, so how can that, you know, what other circumstance would a nice, well-meaning person listen to a story about 5,000 dead babies and then try to justify it? You know, what is it about the moral power of debt that has that effect on people? And that was the sort of puzzle, because I think it's really important. What I was doing politically, and I realized, well, you know, everything I do has to do with debt on some level or another, politically and otherwise, actually. Think about it. The modern nation state runs on deficit financing. Modern economies run on consumer debt. International relations are all about debt nowadays. What is debt anyway? Where's that come from? And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that there's a real unexplored territory here. Nobody has ever written a history of debt. And if you think about that, that's kind of extraordinary in itself, because there are very few things that no one has ever written a history of. I mean, I think, wow, you know, there's some guy wrote a history of cod. yeah, it's not a bad book. There's this French guy wrote a history of shit. You know, it's about human waste disposal through the ages. You know, like almost anything you can think of, somebody's written a history. No one had ever written a history of debt. Credit you can get, but not debt. So I started working on it, and a lot of the things I discovered were quite extraordinary. One of which is that this idea of sort of wiping debt out of the account. You know, we don't have histories of debt. A lot of economics is built on wiping away debt, or wiping away debt as an issue, at least until later. This is a pet peeve I've always had as an anthropologist because, well, all anthropologists have this one pet peeve overall with economists is what we call the myth of barter. This never ceases. You want to annoy an anthropologist, start talking about this. You know, in 1776, Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, and he told this little story. You've all heard it, right? Once upon a time, they didn't have money. So what did they have to do? Well, they had to swap things, you know? So, like, say I want your cow. And I say, tell you what, I'll give you 20 chickens for that cow. You know? And, of course, you'll say, well, I don't know. Chickens aren't that great. And so 30 chickens, 45. All right. And, you know, finally you make a deal. Of course, every now and then he says, yeah, I've got lots of chickens. You know, what else you got? And you don't have anything he wants. And this is called the double coincidence of wants problem. It's in every economics textbook. I actually pulled every economic textbook off the shelf that I could find at the Goldsmiths Library. They all had it bolded. There's, you know, a story of the origins of money. There's a problem with this. There's the logical problem, which I'll get into in a moment. And there's a practical problem, which is there is no place in the world that people actually do this. Which is quite extraordinary. I mean, anthropologists have been going out for 150 years at least trying to find the land of barter where people go up to their neighbors and say, you know, I'll give you 20 chickens for that cow. It doesn't happen. I mean, people will do it with strangers who they'll never meet again sometimes, but you're not going to get a money system arising out of, you know, strangers you never meet again. So because according to the standard story, the barter is inconvenient, so people have to invent money. They say, all right, gold, you know, I'll, you know, most people want that for some reason. And you know, and it becomes a virtuous circle. You start stockpiling it. Soon it turns into money. Government gets in on the deal and stamps it with stuff. Gradually you invent credit systems and, you know, there's straight evolutionary lines. Securitized derivatives are just kind of like a logical last link. So we all learn this, right? Despite the fact that it's completely untrue, there's no place in the world. I mean, we've found lots of economic systems. I mean, an incredible, dazzling variety of different ways to dispose of goods and services in societies without money. Just nobody ever says, I'll give you 30 chickens for that cow. So it makes you want, and they don't change the textbooks. That's why anthropologists get annoyed. If you look at the textbooks, well, they used to say, well, primitive people do this, and, you know, now they can't because they don't. So instead they say, imagine what it would be like if you didn't have money. You'd have to trade things directly, wouldn't you? And then they start telling the same story. It's always this imaginative exercise. So we're always been annoyed by that. But I realized that not only when I was researching this, and not only is it wrong, it's actually backwards. Credit systems appear to come first. The first records we have, about 5,000 years ago, are actually some of the first writing we have is records of debts and credits. You know, Sumerians are when they go to the market, they appear to be just keeping tabs, you know, like they had bar tabs, they had tabs you keep with merchants, and, you know, every 6 months to a year you'd come in and settle with something which is mutually agreeable to both sides. So they have money in the sense that they'd use silver and grain to, like, keep records of who owes what to who, but they didn't actually make scales accurate enough to measure out the tiny amounts of silver that would have been required to buy a chicken or something like that. Actually, they didn't have chickens. Chickens only came in from Southeast Asia under the Urartu period around 500 BC. But they had a duck. So they didn't actually measure them out. I mean, they had the technology to make scales that accurate. They just obviously had no purpose for them. All right. So first you have these credit systems, very elaborate credit systems. You already have expense accounts. You have compounded interest rates, you know, long before the use of currency. Then you get money around 600 BC, roughly. Coinage is invented simultaneously in the Eastern Mediterranean and Northern India and Northern China. And then barter, when it does occur, almost invariably happens in places where people are used to using money, but the money for some reason disappears. So like in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there just wasn't money around and people were doing barter, Argentina, other places like that. All right, so that's backwards. And the more I started thinking about it, the more I realized, well, it's kind of obvious, isn't it, why this story is wrong. It's not just that we haven't found it. It's why would someone behave like this? Because what the economists are assuming is that here you are in a Neolithic village. Often they imagine this, you know, sort of Algonquian or Iroquoian North American community. Here are these neighbors that are coming, they're trading, you know, arrowheads or beaver pelts or something like that. To use that concrete example in a lot of the early texts. Now, they're assuming that all these people are going to be only dealing in what economists call the spot trade, which means, you know, I give you something, you give me something, we walk away. No debt is involved. But that's ridiculous because, like, you know, say I'm trading arrowheads for beaver pelts. A guy doesn't need arrowheads. You know, according to the economists, well, no deal. You know, we can't trade. We have to invent money. Well, the guy's my neighbor. You know, I mean, if I don't need his arrowheads, I'm going to have something he wants, and he knows that. So, you know, the logical thing to do would be to, like, you know, it's nice to have your neighbors and your dad. In fact, if you observe how what actually happens when you do have situations that are sort of like that, and what you find, for example, it's a common practice in many parts of the world, sort of tradition, that if you praise something that someone else has, they pretty much have to give it to you. I mean, this is even the case now. I have a friend from Lebanon who's saying, oh, yeah, we do that. Like, if somebody says, oh, that's a nice necklace, you just say, no, take it. And basically, the only way that you can't do that is to say, oh, is it not, you like it? It's a gift. Someone else gave it to me, you can. In a lot of small-scale communities, you basically can't refuse if somebody praises something. So, you know, what would actually happen if you want the guy's cow is you go up and say, wow, that's a beautiful cow, you know? And the really only thing you can do is to say, oh, really, you like it? I mean, it's really nothing. It's not a very great cow, but, like, take it. No, please, don't even think about giving me anything back. But, of course, now he owes you one, right? And you can come back later, you know, you might show up and say, what a lovely necklace, or you might say, you know, my son is deeply in love with your daughter, or, you know, whatever it might be. Or you might just, like, let it dangle because it's nice to have your neighbor and your dad. And that's what you generally find in societies without money is this sort of rank of sorts of things. Like, you know, a cow is roughly like a canoe and roughly like a really nice necklace, but a chicken is more like a kind of cheesy necklace. And, you know, you have different ranks of sorts of things that are sort of basically equivalent. But you don't have money because what money involves is mathematical proportionality. You know, be able to say 17 of these equals one of those. That's what really sort of brings it over to money. It's not a rank system. It involves proportionality. And it's hard to imagine. You know, you could see how money would arise in the economist model if you're bartering, and they come up with all these very complex mathematical models to show how that would happen. It's really hard to see how it would do that in the sort of broad, I kind of owe you one, debt system. Because, you know, you could do things like you could head somebody off. There's tactics like that. So you can say, well, you know, I owe him a cow. I don't really want to give him that. I'm going to give him something else, but it's not really worth that. But make a big thing out of it, and I'll give him some chickens. You know, if you do that, he might mock you as a cheapskate, but he's very unlikely to come up with a mathematical formula to figure out exactly how cheap he thinks you just were. The question is, under what circumstance are you going to be able to say how many chickens equals one cow, and thus develop a monetary system? Well, it seems like it would normally happen when the evidence that we have is that it would normally happen when somebody is extremely angry and where violence either has or ensued or might, or both. Again, our imaginary scenario: I give the guy a cow, he gives me back something cheap, I make fun of him, we're drunk, blows ensue, somebody's ear gets cut off. Well, you will discover that in a lot of times and places where you don't have markets, you actually do have very precise schedules of compensation. You know, one eye equals 27 heifers, one ear equals 17 heifers, you know, one, you know, severed toe, depending on size, yeah, and so forth and so on. And they're very specific about that, very exact. And if you think about it, what is the circumstance where you're most likely to say, no, I demand 27 heifers, or, you know, exactly, and this means war. Exactly a situation where, you know, otherwise we might be, like, talking about a feud here or some sort of violence. And on the other hand, if suddenly the guy doesn't actually have any heifers, well, you have to substitute something else, and you have to figure out exactly how to do that. So In fact, if you look, for example, at early Irish or Welsh medieval law codes, it's a perfect example of this sort of thing. In the Welsh law codes, they actually specify the exact monetary value of every single object likely to exist in a person's house, from the silverware in the cauldron to the rafters and the floor beams, you know, everything. And despite the fact that they didn't have markets and you couldn't buy any of this stuff. Well, why? It was for paying compensation. In fact, in both medieval Wales and Ireland, they had this idea of the honor price. Money was largely used to pay compensation for things in the legal system, and everybody actually had their honor could be precisely calculated, up to kings, including kings, and the the judges would either promote you or demote you, depending on your behavior. So if you're a king, you got a base of, I think, 24 cows honor price. But if you did something really dishonorable, like you ran away in battle, they'd cut it down to 12. And like, that was the price they'd have to pay if they insulted you. And it was a higher price than actual murder. So, like, if you kill someone, it was ordinarily, like, you know, 6 cows. But then you'd have to pay 12 more for insulting you by murdering you. So, anyway, they had to do substitution. That's where money comes in. So it seems like situations like that, where there is violence or potential violence, is where people start getting exact. Proportionality comes in. This connection between money and violence and debt is something that cropped up over and over and over again when I started doing this study. And I think it helped explain one of the problems that I started with, which is the deep moral ambivalence, which is what I was trying to understand. When I first started looking at the problem of debt, the first thing that leaped out at me was the apparently completely contradictory attitudes that people had towards it. So that, for example, this idea that paying your debts is morality, you know, obligations are debts, let's think of them as such, everything's a debt you owe to somebody or another, being a good person is just a matter of paying your debts. You see that over and over again, wherever you go. On the other hand, pretty much every place in the world, they also have an idea that people who lend money for a living are evil. It's really hard to figure out how to square those two things. And that moral ambivalence, it runs through everything. That, you know, every religious text, philosophical text, debt always crops up, and then people don't quite know what to do with it. There's a sense that, you know, lending money is bad, borrowing money is bad. If you imagine life is just a bunch of transactions where all we're doing is lending and borrowing things, everybody's bad. Commercial economies usually conclude that people are just bad. Human sociality itself is kind of suspect. There's a great Japanese Buddhist, that brought this home to me first. Some medieval Buddhist monk is telling a story of strange events during his lifetime in Japan. And he has a story of, I guess you could call it, a premature reincarnation. There's this money lender. She's married to the governor, but she's, like, horrible and exacting and ruins people's lives by never letting him off the hook for her loans. She charges very high interest. She dies, and they're saying prayers over the body. And after 2 days, suddenly it springs to life, but it's half ox. This horrible, twisted monster, which, you know, they're all, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? They give back all the money. They're, you know, finally, it mercifully dies. And the monk who's telling the story says, well, you know, in the sutras that they talk about debt, they say that if you owe money to someone, because, you know, Buddhism is interesting, unlike Christianity and Islam, and doesn't really have a problem with charging interest. They say, if you owe money to someone and you don't pay it back, it's a real danger because you might end up dying and being, when you die, being reborn as an ox in their barn. However, adds the monk, obviously in this case it was the other way around, so I guess it must be the case that, like, if somebody else owes you money and you really give them a hard time and are unreasonable about it, well, you know, you could get reborn an ox in their barn. I thought about it, and so, well, but of course you're not going to be giving them a hard time unless they're not paying you the money they owe, right? So aren't they kind of both in danger of getting reborn as an ox in the other guy's barn? And who decides? You know, I mean, is there some sort of balance? It's just like touch and go there. You know, like if I don't, you know, hold back too much or you're too aggressive, you know, we see which one actually gets, you know, reborn in the other's barn. And it brings home something of that moral ambivalence, I think. Both parties, one party's definitely guilty, the other one's probably guilty. In fact, words for guilt, sin, and debt are the same in any number of languages, including the languages of the great world religions in Sanskrit and Aramaic. And as a result, almost invariably in like the great religious texts, they start by saying, well, debt, you know, morality is just paying your debts, debt, obligation, same thing. And then they say, well, except not really. And they kind of move away from it. Actually, you know, the Republic, founding document of Western political philosophy, starts in exactly the same way. Socrates is pondering what is justice, and his host, this guy named Cephalos, which means capital, he's a arms manufacturer, says to him, all right, well, that's not a hard problem. I mean, justice, it's just a matter of paying your debts and not lying. And Socrates, you know, kind of blows that one out of the water right away, if you've read the book. You know, he's like, oh, that's silly. I mean, you know, imagine somebody lends me his sword. And then he goes violently insane and wants it back to kill a bunch of people. Would it be just to give it to him? You know, of course not. So guy's like, okay, not that, something else. I don't know. Doesn't matter. I got to go someplace. And they end up having an argument about it. And the rest of the book is basically saying, well, if not that, then what? But in a similar way, that same problem shows up over and over again in the Brahmanas. Great Hindu texts. They start by saying your life is a debt that you owe to the gods. Or sometimes you are yourself a debt that is owed to the gods. Which you kind of pay the interest through animal sacrifice, and then you pay the principal when you die. So, you know, they start like that, but then they say, well, you know, but you owe other existential debts as well. You owe debts to your parents, you know, which you repay by becoming a parent. And you owe debts to the sages who created wisdom, and you repay that by becoming a sage. And, you know, you owe debts to humanity as a whole to make life possible, and you can repay that by being hospitable to strangers. And by the time it's over, you realize they're not talking about debt at all, right? Because you don't actually pay back. You know, if your parents lend you money, you can't, like, pay them back by lending it to someone else. What they're really saying, you know, you really paying these people back by annihilating the difference between you. You know, you become a parent. You become a sage. You become humane. And if you think about it, what is a ritual of sacrifice is, you know, an expression of unity with the cosmos. Because what is, you know, to say you're in debt to the cosmos, and this is what I always say to people who talk about debt to nature, debt to society. It seems an appealing notion, but a debt is a business contract between two legally equal parties, you know, to do whatever it is they do. It's a transaction between two equivalent parties. What does it mean to say that I am entering into a business contract with the cosmos? You know, me and everything else that has ever existed or ever will exist, including myself, are making a little deal together. It's obviously absurd. And essentially that's what the gods are, right? They're the cosmos. You can only repay the debt by realizing there is no debt because you are the cosmos, which is, you know, in fact what people ultimately conclude. In the Old Testament, you know, the New Testament too, there's the same sort of thing going on. They oppose debt as morality. In Aramaic, the word debt and sin are the same. So the Lord's Prayer, for example, you know, that whole forgive us our trespasses just as we forgive those who trespass against us, that's the Anglican translation. I think that's from the 1560s. But the original, even the original translation by John Wycliffe is what it literally says in the Aramaic text, which is forgive us our debts just as we forgive those who owe us money. But of course, there's a catch here, right? Like, we don't normally forgive those who owe us money, do we? Yeah. So it's sort of a way of saying, yeah, you're a sinner, you should go to hell. And in fact, there's a parable just like this in the New Testament where they basically say that. But again, what is sacred is not paying your debts. What is sacred, it turns out, is debt forgiveness, redemption. Redemption being a classic, you know, Iron Age financial term. And In fact, in the Middle East, there was a tradition of debt cancellation, which was created by sacred kings in their cosmic capacity, and then the prophets had it installed as jubilee. So the idea of wiping away of debts was a grand cosmic sacred gesture, which paying debts was not. So over and over again, they start with debt and as being morality, and then they say, except it isn't. Well, why do they start that way then? And the more I thought about it, and I connected it to the connection of debt and violence, I realized that, in a way, the idea of debt, well, what is a debt? Debt is not just an obligation, it's a quantifiable obligation. It is an obligation where you can state exactly how much somebody owes. Because it's quantifiable, it can be turned into mathematics. It's also impersonal. Doesn't matter who it's between, and it's transferable because it's impersonal. So, you know, so it's really a promise that has, you might say, corrupted by math and violence. You know, if I make a promise to you to meet you at 5, you can't give that promise to someone else, right? But, you know, if I make a promise to pay you money, then you can, and in fact, that's what money really is circulating promises. The fascinating thing is that combination appears to be the most effective language ever created to take what is a relation of violent inequality and turn it into something that not only seems moral, but where it's the victims who seem like they're the moral reprobates who should be ashamed and are to blame. I mean, mafiosi understand this, right? But, you know, sort of heads of conquering armies, the usual line is pretty predictable. You come in, you say, all right, I've conquered you, and you owe me your lives. I mean, literally, because I could have killed you. I didn't. You owe me your life. I expect payment. I'm a nice guy. I'm going to let you off the hook for the first 6 months, you know. After that, negotiable, but I do expect payment. And, you know, suddenly you're, like, running around feeling like a schmo and trying to come up with the cash, and he's being the benevolent person. And this has happened throughout human history over and over again. And it's very effective, except the problem is that it tends to blow up periodically. And the worm in the bud is that thing about equal contractual relationship. That is to say, you are accepting that people are equal on some potential level. They could, you know, if you can't repay it, it's not a debt. So the result is quite interesting because, you know, if it turns out, and I think Moses Finley, the great classicist, kept repeating this over and over again. I found like 8 different books where he said the same thing. He said there's basically one revolutionary program in all of antiquity, which is cancel the debts and redistribute the land. Not a bad idea in general. And it sticks in people's heads. Actually, I was just reading like the John Adams, I'm throw this in, I don't usually, but where he's saying why democracy would be a bad idea. You know, all the founding fathers are actually completely opposed to democracy. But he says majority vote, that's ridiculous. I mean, we have like 1 million people with property and 9 million people without. The first thing they'll do if they get the vote is like cancel the debts and redistribute the land. So, you know, it's kind of a perennial thing. All right, so so people, 90% of all insurrections in world history have been about debt, which is really interesting because you think about it, there's a lot of things to rebel against throughout world history. You know, people don't rebel about serfdom, slavery, caste systems. I mean, they do, but not nearly so much. At debt all the time. First thing peasant rebels will normally do is go for the debt registers and burn them. You know, after that, maybe the land surveys and maybe the tax rolls. Yeah. But always debt first. And I guess the reason has to be that, you know, if you tell somebody you are inferior, that's annoying. But if you tell somebody, you know, you should be my equal, but you fucked up, and therefore you're morally inadequate, you know, it's a lot more insulting. It's really annoying. And it tends to blow up periodically. When it blows up, you know, it's kind of hard not to come up with a response at a certain point to say, now, wait a minute, who owes what to who here? But the moment you say that, right, well, you're speaking the master's language. You're using the language of debt. You're saying it's, you know, morality is a matter of owing. And that's how you have all morality suddenly transferred into debt, because that's the language you're stuck with in talking to the emperor. And I think that, you know, if we think about the great religious documents, I mean, we don't have any way of knowing now if, like, you know, two people are hanging around at the bar at 800 BC in Mesopotamia and arguing about politics, you know, what they're talking about. We can be pretty sure that debt was one of the things they were talking about. But, you know, how they – the phrases they used, the language, the political debates of the time, the issues. But, you know, it's pretty – bet you anything that those religious texts are riddled with popular political phrases of the day that we just don't know what the, you know, the ancient Mesopotamian equivalent of it's the economy, stupid, or something. we just don't recognize them anymore. So we say, oh, what an interesting poetic turn. So they're arguing about it, and it becomes lodged in the language. And then, you know, when they actually talk about what really matters to them, they have to take this language, which is the language of the day, and kind of move away from it. Say, well, except not really. So that is one way to think about the terrible moral power of debt. So then the question becomes one of social struggle. How is struggles about debt? Another thing that I found really striking when I suddenly thought about it was, you know, most people have lived in states because states tend to have denser populations than societies without states. The overwhelming majority of people who've ever lived have been told that they were debtors. Well, think about that, right? I mean, how is that morally possible? I mean, it's like a tiny percentage of the population of humanity like really done so much for everybody else that they're that all those people who've ever lived are in their debt. What did they do? in fact, we have this running through history, and it doesn't. It's hardly surprising then that social struggles have revolved around it for so long. However, the outcome of those social struggles has changed, has varied in different periods, and it has a lot to do with the form of money people are using. And here's where you go back to the whole question of barter, money, credit. Actually, suddenly, you see there's a kind of shape. If you look at the history of Eurasia, at least, there are certain patterns which are remarkably coordinated all the way from one end of the Eurasian continent to the other. Everything seems to happen in sync. That is, history goes back and forth between periods dominated by virtual credit money. But there's usually some kind of control over the phenomenon of debt, and periods dominated were by gold and silver. I mean, this is another interesting thing about economists. I was very amused to learn that economists, actually, there's no consensus among economists about what money is, which, you know, you'd think if there's anything they would have down by now, right? That would be it, but no. There's a one dominant school, which is the Adam Smithian sort of, it's a currency, it's mainly a medium of exchange, and people start using it as a medium, and then it kind of comes to represent the value of other things. But there's an entirely different school, the Chartalists, who say that no, money is a measure of value, it doesn't necessarily have to be a medium of exchange, it's a way of keeping account of comparing things. Which is usually established by public authorities of one kind or another, rather than the Adam Smith version, where it happens spontaneously. The problem, well, most economists sort of accept the currency, the medium of exchange version, but the reason that the other side doesn't go away, even though there a lot of economists think they're cranks and wingnuts, is because, like, all evidence that we have points to the other guys being right. it's a bit of a quandary. So first you have money as the sort of Chartalists would say, as this, and as I was saying in Sumer, as a way of measuring value where you're not actually using stuff at all. But when that is the case, when money is simply a way of measuring value, you often have a problem with debt, because the problem of the debt trap. And throughout world history, in most times and places, this is kind of a nightmare situation. What everybody's afraid of, if you're talking about Hammurabi or, you know, a Confucian writing in the Tang Dynasty or Aristotle, you know, trying to imagine the worst thing that can happen, society goes into total crisis, falls apart, you know, what you wouldn't wish on anyone, this is it. The debt trap. People get so deeply in debt that, you know, they start selling everything off. They sell off their flocks, they sell off their fields, and they come for the family, you know. Their family's getting repossessed. They eventually have to sell themselves into slavery, you know, to save their family. It's just like the nightmare scenario. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, generally speaking, people force some kind of safeguard here. It's the focus of endless unrest and political maneuvering throughout history. What that solution is varies depending on what people think money is. It's a big problem when you have a credit system because if money is just an IOU, it's just an arrangement, well, what's to stop people from generating it infinitely, to stop people from falling into debt traps? Hence, the solution is simply, well, at the very beginning, the solution is just cancel the debts periodically. And this was done quite regularly. The first word for freedom that we know from any human language is amargi, a Sumerian word, which literally means return to mother. Because new kings would come in and they would say, okay, debt freedom, everybody go home. And all the debt peons would, you know, like the debts would be canceled and everybody who's like laboring in somebody else's household would go back to their mom again. But it's kind of interesting because that word has become – I just read this on the internet. I'm very proud of this. That word has become – amargi has become like really big with libertarians who don't know this. They think it means tax relief or tax cancellation. So there's all these guys with like, you know, big amargi tattoos on their arms, but in cuneiform. But, you know, it actually means like, you know, welching on your debts and going back to have mom take care of you again. anyway, so that's debt freedom is the first form of, you know, word for freedom. So they would cancel the debts, and then there's the Jubilee, where it becomes institutionalized in ancient Judea every 7 to 49 years, depending on who you ask. They would just cancel debts. Everybody got to go home. Now, that's one approach. Now, in the ancient world, well, money, this is a very interesting thing, too. Money in the form of currency gets invented, as I was saying, near simultaneously in India, China, and the Eastern Aegean. In every case, it seems to be first used to pay soldiers. Again, this connection of money and violence. And that also makes sense in a certain way, because you're imagining this, you know, barter scenario that the economists have in mind. Well, it's not going to apply in a credit situation where people trust each other. But in a situation of war and violence, it actually starts making a lot more sense on any number of different levels. I mean, from the perspective of a conquering army, you know, they like gold and silver a lot more than they like credit arrangements because, well, what's the big advantage of gold and silver over a credit arrangement? You can't really steal a credit arrangement. Gold and silver just carry off. It's basically the ancient equivalent of the suitcase full of $100 bills. You know, nobody knows where it's from. They don't care that anybody will take it. So, you know, soldiers will be likely to be carrying off gold and silver, which is the basis of this credit currency, even though it's not actually used and actually using it. From the perspective of merchants who are normally used to operating on credit, a big, scary soldier with lots of weapons who's probably just passing through is the worst credit risk imaginable. Exactly the sort of person you would least like to extend credit to. But he's got the little bits of gold and silver. So, you know, markets where they're actually using the currency are most likely to occur around armies. Now, what you see in almost every case, again, is people are starting to use this metal currency and then kings get involved and start making it themselves. And this actually is one of the great mysteries that has – it doesn't seem like it should be a mystery, but it is – that we've seen over and over again throughout world history is why is it kings demanded taxes in the form of gold and silver? Now, on the surface, it doesn't seem like there should be a mystery at all, right? Because if gold and silver is money, they want it, right? But if gold and silver just become money spontaneously through trade, like the sort of Adam Smith version, well, the logical thing to do would be to grab the gold and silver mines, and then you have all the money. And in fact, that is what kings would do. They would go and grab the gold and silver mines. So what's the point of taking all the gold and silver, stamping your picture on it, giving it to people, and then say, okay, everybody give me one back again? You know, it doesn't make a lot of obvious sense unless you're trying to feed an army, because feeding an army was really hard under ancient conditions. You have 50,000 people all in one place. Well, you know, transportation isn't very good, unless they're by the water, where it's much easier. If they're on land, basically they're going to eat anything that is edible within a matter of weeks, you know, within walking distance. So after that, either you need to employ another 50,000 people getting food to them, or you can just give them little pieces of gold and silver, which is the kind of thing they're going to be use it anyway, and then say, all right, everybody in the kingdom has to give me one of those back. You know, voila, you've just hired your entire population to get soldiers things they need because they have to get those pieces of silver off the soldiers again. So, in fact, if you look at the period of what Karl Jaspers, the existential philosopher, called the Axial Age, runs roughly from about 600 when coins are invented to, there's different versions. I take the long one, which goes to about 600 AD. It's a period dominated by gold, silver, and bronze coins all the way across Eurasia. People are actually using coins in everyday transactions. It's a period where you first see little fighting kingdoms coalesce into giant empires. Giant empires are based on standing armies, which are paid in coins. There's what has been called the military coinage slavery complex. Chattel slavery is not a very important institution at almost any other period of time in China and India, for example, but it is in this period, and it is, of course, basis of Greece and Rome. So these armies are going off. They're getting paid in gold and silver. They're taking lots of slaves, putting the slaves to work in the mines to get more gold and silver to pay the soldiers. You know, it becomes a kind of circle. During this period, they don't forgive the debts. So they have to come up with something else. But you still see debt revolts. I mean, the constitutions of Athens, of Rome, all came out of debt crises. And in this case, the solution is rather different. The solution is you basically buy people off and draft them into the army. So they throw money at the problem, basically. That's what coins are often a solution to the problem of debt crises, rather than the cause of them. So, for example, in ancient Athens, most people don't realize this, but ancient Athenians were paid to vote. If you go to the Agora, they actually give you money. Jury duty, too, is like the support of the Athenian poor. So they're actually, you know, taking these slaves, putting them to work in the mines, getting the silver, giving it to people, you know, constantly, you know, sort of throwing money at the problem to keep debt from overtaking people. Roman bread and circuses is sort of the same principle. I mean, this works in militarily powerful states. Other ones are in trouble. Gradually, the other thing you happen, this is really fascinating. For some reason that no one has ever explained, in the exact same times and places that you see the invention of coinage, you also see the invention of all major schools of world philosophy. In fact, you know, all of them in all of those places. Karl Jasper and his pupils, I think, you say there basically have been no real new ideas since this period of time. They come up with all of them. They also come up with all the world religions between 600 BC and 600 AD. And it seems that most of these philosophical and religious movements start as anti-war movements. So they are social movements. And they also, you know, sort of pose values directly opposed to those of these newly impersonal cash markets that are occurring, which kind of makes sense. You know, in anthropology, we talk about schismogenesis. You know, you start, like, to oppose things like this, and you sort of, like, work to the point where you're so far apart you can't possibly be more opposed. Something like this seems to be happening. In traditional societies, you know, either the idea of egoism or altruism are very difficult to imagine because, you know, human motivations are assumed to be inherently complicated. A purely good or a purely selfish act is almost inconceivable because, you know, there's a lot going on. But they come up with it in this period. And it's largely because, you know, if you have a market, if you have some space where you say, like, while you're here, just think about the stuff. You're just thinking about getting as much material stuff for yourself as possible. It almost inevitable that someone else will say, okay, and here we'll have this space, we'll call it religion, where we think about why material things are not important. And, you know, why to give is better than to receive. Let's invent charity. All the world religions come up with charity, which hadn't really existed as a concept before. So these kind of emerge in relation to one another in this period. But gradually, the world religions kind of take over the markets. And this happens in each case in India, China, and in the Roman Empire. There's a crisis. The empire kind of comes to its height. It has to come to a deal with one of these religions. It adopts it with various, sometimes more effectively than others. Gradually, the empires collapse. Now, and you go to the medieval period. The first thing that happens in that medieval period is standing armies vanish, so do the coins. Most of the gold and silver gets locked up in temples and monasteries. People go back to credit systems. So that the check, word check is an Arab word, meaning check. people are already 800, 900 AD. They're using checks to buy everyday transactions in places like Basra. Actually, I always like to tell people when they talk about financial globalization as if it's a new phenomenon. Think of the words cash and check. The word check, you know, comes from an Arabic word meaning check. And the word cash, that's a double etymology, but it partially derived from a a Tamil word for Chinese currency. How did that happen? Okay, so you have checks. China, they have paper money, you know. It was originally credit systems the government sort of appropriates. In Europe, they have this very complicated system. You know, we all hear after the collapse of the Roman Empire in the Middle Ages, we reverted to barter. No, not really. Actually, what they had was a system of what they called at the time imaginary money. They were still using Roman money, but they just didn't have any of it. So they were keeping accounts and paying, you know, paying interest, and, you know, like calculating rents, and, you know, in money that did no longer physically existed. So it goes back to this virtual money system. Then they do it with the Carolingian money. So, like, you know, pounds, shillings, and pence actually existed as a unit of account long before anybody actually coined them. At least the pounds, because Charlemagne never made any pounds. He never got up to that, but they were still using that. What did they actually do? Well, I mean, there were a lot of notch sticks. The tally sticks were one of the chief ways of actually keeping accounts of who owed what to whom. I mean, mostly in medieval villages, you just remember because, you know, like everybody keeps account. I owe you 3 shillings for that pig. You owe me this. You owe me that. And then, you know, like every 6 months to a year, you have what you call a reckoning, and you sort of do it in a big circle. Okay, you owe this to me. You owe 3, 3, 3. That cancels out. And you cancel out as much as you can, and anything that's left over, then you give somebody some cheese or, you know, if you have some cash lying around, you know, whatever it might be. And at this point, you know, everybody assumes that, like, money is whatever the king says it is. You have this abstract system, but the king can just say, okay, cheese is money this year, you know, because that's, you know, I'll accept it in taxes, it's money. You know, nobody thinks that money is a fixed thing. It's this idea that we have, a social convention. So people assume that money is this abstraction, social arrangement. The tally sticks, oh yeah, the tally sticks are cool. Tally sticks are these sticks that are broken in half, because anytime you break a stick in half, it's unique. It's a unique configuration. So you notch the sticks to figure out who owes what to whom, and then you break them in half, and one half is called the stock, and the other half is called the stub. That's where those words come from. Exactly the same system is being used in China. I actually found this great Taoist joke from like 200 AD about this guy is walking along the street and he finds a half of a tally stick. He's like, oh my God, check out all those notches, you know, like just figure out who has the other side of this stick. I am rich. all right, so... You know, they have tally sticks. You have various systems. The religions sort of take over the monitoring of these credit systems. What's the first thing they do? They have to set up some system to protect debtors, sort of, because now that you can, you know, generate money infinitely, you have to have some kind of control. So in their case, they don't mostly do debt cancellation. In China, they do. It's one of the things they do. But in most of the rest of the world, in Islam and Christianity, they just outlaw taking interest at all. You have to do profit sharing. And they also outlaw debt peonage and various other classic, you know, abuses to allow, you know, that force people into debt traps. Now, this, you know, actually the Middle Ages looks kind of good. Chattel slavery also disappears, which is one of the most fascinating things for me. It's clear there's some sort of social movements involved in this happening, but it's all below the radar. We don't really know how it happened. And if you think about it, you know, in 300 AD, 40% of the population of Italy were chattel slaves. By 200 years later, it was like none. Yeah, what happened, right? I mean, you know, we think of this period as the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. It's supposed to be a great tragedy. I doubt it was felt as a great tragedy for all those guys who were slaves, right? I suspect they thought whatever happened was kind of cool. But you know, how that happened, we don't really understand. History is... And if you even think of the shrinking of cities, you know, it seems it doesn't do great things for world culture, but, you know, for every guy who's, like, living in ancient Syracuse, learning poetry and, you know, looking at nice sculptures, there's got to be, like, 5 guys whose only job was to, like, make food for them and had no other life, you know. Suddenly, you know, cities collapse. I mean, okay, there was a feudal elite and people were serfs, but, like, you know, really, how much could those guys eat? There really weren't that many of them compared to these cities of millions of people that there were in the ancient world. So it's clear that, you know, people were actually doing much better in the Middle Ages for the most part. However, you know, then there's a series of things happen starting around 1450, where you start moving back to metal. And then, of course, with the discovery of the Americas, it actually all starts in China with this quarrel over paper money and taxes, but I can't go into that. What it creates is this huge demand for silver in China, which allows the Spaniards and Portuguese to, you know, sort of maintain their empires when they discover the New World. If it wasn't for the demand for silver in China, like, Mexico, Peru would have collapsed, just would have been economically unviable in about 10, 20 years. But the result is huge floods of gold and silver, you know, sweep into the Eurasian world. You go back to a system where money is assumed to be precious metals. You get big empires of standing armies again. You get slavery comes back again. And that's the period that's ending now. Yes. 1971 is usually the cutoff date that people name. That's the date that Richard Nixon officially took the dollar off the gold standard. I don't know if people know the story of how that happened. It's kind of interesting. It all happened because of France, because Nixon was having a hard time paying for the Vietnam War. And at that time, dollars were redeemable for gold in other countries. And Charles de Gaulle decided to call his bluff and said, okay, we want our gold. And Nixon was like, the Bank of England was doing it a little bit too, and they got a lot of gold. But the floor of the Bank of England collapsed actually under all the weight of all the gold they were like getting from Fort Knox. And Nixon started to say, "This is ridiculous." No, so actually, underneath the Federal Reserve Building, I always thought this was a myth when I was growing up, but it's actually true. And underneath the Federal Reserve Building in New York, about 30%, they estimate, of all gold that is ever mined is down there in these vaults. And there's like hundreds of chambers, and they're numbered, so the, you know, like the little peons who move around the gold don't know what they are. But that's what they do. They have these hydraulic, like, you know, things where they pick up the gold and they move it. Like, if the Central Bank of Brazil has a settled balance of payments of Germany, they just like, take it out of bank, you know, vault 339 and move it to bank 12. And so Nixon was like, okay, we'll just put money in your vault down here. And finally, after Charles de Gaulle died, I think Pompidou decided no. He sent a battleship to New York Harbor. And he said, put the gold in there. And Nixon said, yeah, I'm going off the gold standard. Ha, ha, ha. You know, what are you going to do, nuke me? Which is why, you know, I don't really worry about all this money we're supposed to, like, load to China. You know, what are they going to do? It's the same thing. You know, you're the world's premier military power. You don't have to do anything you don't want to do. All right, so we went off the gold standard. A lot of things started happening right around that time, right? We go from, you know, suddenly plastic replaces cash. And, you know, really 10, 20 years, nobody was using credit cards back in 71. You get the financialization of capital. At this point, only like 16%, and this is even on paper, of profits from U.S. corporations have anything to do with, like, making stuff or selling things. It's all financial speculation. You have suddenly credit drives the economy. Everybody has, you know, rather wages no longer go up, and instead, like, we all get credit, 401ks, microcredit's going to save the third world. You know, you have this huge credit system, which is kind of the thing that started to fall apart in 2008. But it's not surprising that it did, because if you look at it in world historical terms, we're used to thinking of virtual money as being this crazy new thing that's made possible by new technology, by computers. Well, you know, one thing that becomes very clear if you look at the 5,000-year history is, no, this is a really old pattern. This is the original form of money. This is the predominant form of money that we've had from human history. We're just going back to it again. And obviously, we're never going to go back to it the same way twice. But one thing that seems very clear is that in periods dominated by virtual money, like the ancient Mesopotamia or the Middle Ages, you have to set up some sort of system to protect debtors from creditors, you know, whether it's cancellations or usury laws or whatever they may be, or else you get, you know, people falling into these terrible debt traps. And, well, look around us. You know, what did they do? First of all, they did it backwards. They created the IMF, you know, which is to protect creditors against debtors. And, you know, there's a million other giant institutions like that, which all are to protect creditors. And sure enough, you know, most of the population of the earth is now falling into terrible debt traps. As I always like to say, if we had like some kind of time machine and we got plucked Aristotle out of Athens and brought him here, and he were to look around, you know, and he was to look at modern Americans, you know, he would think that the distinction between being so deeply indebted that you are selling yourself to work for others and being so deeply indebted that you are renting yourself to work for others to be something of a legalistic distinction. Yeah, I mean, he would conclude, yeah, wage slavery is slavery. I mean, he wouldn't have made any difference between it. And so we're actually experiencing, like, you know, the thing that most people in history were, like, terrified of happening. However, upside of all this, you know, we're talking 500-year cycles here. 30 years is nothing. You know, we still have plenty of time to get it right. And I think that what we found out in 2008 is that, you know, we're dealing with antiquated monetary assumptions, ideas about money, which are completely inappropriate to the age in which we now live. I guess we learned a lot of things in 2008, right? One of which is something that is also very, very clear if you look at history, which is that debts mean very, very different things depending on who they're between. And it is always the case, I have this phrase I made up, the communism of the rich. Rich people can be incredibly decent, forgiving, understanding when dealing with each other. I mean, you know, sometimes they play games like Goldman Sachs versus Lehman Brothers. Ha ha ha, I fucked you. But you know, I mean, you know, basically when, like, their common interests are really threatened, they pull together and they do what they need to do to help each other. And poor people do that too, if they can. It's just, so debts between, you know, if I lend money to my brother, I'm probably because he'd be embarrassed if I gave it to him as a gift and I'd say it's a loan, but I don't really expect, you know, everything's negotiable. You know, and if rich people owe money to each other, it appears to be the same. However, if you owe money to a rich person, oh my God, that's sacred. How could you even think? You know, I mean, that's where this whole sacredness of debt rhetoric comes in, and people fall for it. It's until it explodes. Now, I think what we're seeing here is precisely that. We're getting to a point of explosion because in 2008 it was very clearly revealed that, you know, money is not a thing. Money is a promise. Money is an arrangement. It's a social understanding, a social arrangement that people make with one another. It's a series of IOUs. Now, therefore, when circumstances change, like any promise, it can be, you know, renegotiated. Part of the nature of promises when they are between equals. Now, that's what happened, right? Like, what was it, $13 trillion worth of debts were sort of made to disappear by waving various types of magical wands of one kind or another. And, you know, meanwhile, your debt, no, that's completely different. That's sacred. I mean, you know, the irony is, like, they could have actually bailed out the banks by just paying off all the mortgages. Yeah, but they chose not to. They chose to just give the money directly to the banks.